Hello and welcome to Healing the Divide. I am your host, Scott Feinberg, and I am so grateful for you tuning in today and joining us for this conversation. Today, I am joined by a dear friend of many, many years, Mary Consort, to dive into some ancient Indian healing systems, more specifically, the disciplines and systems and practices of Jyotish, which is a form of ancient Vedic or Indian astrology, and also Ayurveda, commonly referred to as the sister science of yoga. I want to offer Mary a little bit of an introduction here and give you guys a background about her work. She has been a yoga practitioner for over 23 years now, since 2001. She's been teaching since 2005. Her initial training was in the Shivananda lineage with her teacher, Bharata, at Yoga and Inner Peace in Lake Worth, Florida. She is trained in trauma-informed yoga, chair yoga, vinyasa yoga, and kids yoga. A certified Ayurvedic practitioner, Mary works with her clients at her studio, Celestial Wellness, in Juno Beach, Florida, incorporating Ayurveda, yoga, and Jyotish in her consultations. She is a devoted student of Sanskrit and an enthusiastic teacher of yoga and its sister sciences. Mary, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I'm so excited to dive into all of this. And a little timely context for our listeners. So Mary and I both have yoga studios in the same town, and it's amazing because we have this incredible, not only friendship, but collaborative relationship, and Mary is currently teaching inside of our 300-hour advanced yoga teacher training modules on Ayurveda, Jyotish, and also Sanskrit, where we're looking at the actual letters and how to recognize symbols in the Devanagari script, and then looking at the euphonics and looking at all of these different elements of pronunciation and of this vibrational language. And it's really been an incredible experience to learn more about spaces I haven't known as much about with Jyotish and going deeper into Ayurveda. Right now, our group is in the middle of many of them doing a cleanse, according to Ayurveda, as part of their training. And it's been so eye-opening and heart-opening that I invited Mary to be here today on the podcast. So to give a little structure or shape to this conversation, we're going to start big picture with Vedic astrology or Jyotish as a way of contextualizing the human incarnate journey from birth and then into how we navigate the rhythms of our lives according to these sort of embedded proclivities that we might find in our nature through the practices of Ayurveda, and not only how we balance our own rhythms, but how we balance them in alignment with calendrical cycles and the movements of our planet and of the moon and all these like stellar and who knows, maybe even interstellar dynamics. So Mary, thank you so much. And I'd love to begin the conversation with really just an exploration of, I guess I want to phrase it this way. What is your interpretation of the difference between what is natural and what has become normal?
I think that it just starts with exploration and understanding of what we're made of and who we are and what supports us. And from a dosha perspective, if that's where you're going, a lot of the things that become normal for us, we've kind of, you know, assimilated into our own experience, and they, although they're normal for us, they may not be what nature intends for us. So I think it begins with understanding who you are, what you're made of, what environment you're in.
Yeah, it's so fascinating because when I think about the idea of the podcast is healing the divide, and one of those divides is the divide that exists within us, you know, not just between us one-to-one or as a society, but like, do I even know what I am made of? Like, how do we even begin to carve out a life if we don't have an understanding of what we are? And so much of that feels hidden. Even from whether it's our personality in the first few years of our life and how much is shaped, but it's sort of barricaded off from our memory, or what the universe was doing at the moment of our birth and how that may have informed our human experience. And I have always entered into this realm of spiritual inquiry with a certain sense of skepticism. And I've really leaned on it, not as cynicism, but as like a, almost like a strainer for things to pass through. So I've struggled a lot with things that are more like astrological or harder to touch and make connections. But I've really appreciated your approach to teaching it, and it's made it maybe for the first time for me accessible. And so I'm really hoping that whether somebody is listening and is really like dialed into this, they get it, they're aligned, or they're like, ah, I don't know if this one's for me. This, you know, I am excited for the opportunity to maybe share some of these things in new ways. So that said, starting with the big picture of what the universe was up to at the moment of our birth, this exists, as I understand it, within going all the way back to Vedic times and the Vedangas, and understanding for our listeners, these six auxiliary disciplines of Vedic practice, and one of them being understanding the cycles of the sun and the moon and the equinoxes and the solstices, and how to time rituals for optimal auspiciousness.
Back then, we had time to look at the skies and record everything. That was, you know, we didn't have all the distractions that we have now. And so they would watch the skies and know, you know, every time that this looks like this, that happens. Every time that that looks like that, that happens. So it's the observation was really so much the basis of Jyotish in Vedic times.
It's really fascinating. And forgive me if there was a little overlap. I think we maybe glitched for a moment. But I picked up on what you were saying as really there's something beautiful of like looking back at thousands and thousands of years ago and imagining the level of discipline that it would have to require to observe these patterns in the sky, because in order to develop that sight, you have to be watching pretty steadfastly over a long period of time enough to discern, okay, this is a cycle. And then looking at the results of those things. And that it reminds me of being in Machu Picchu and the archaeoastronomy of like how temples were built according to where the sun would rise on the solstice so that it would enter into, that's how we're going to construct our window. So the light enters where we hold the ceremony in the temple. And it's like, wow.
Yep. So Vedic astrology, Jyotishic, helps us start to tune in to things like that, to what's going on in the skies.
What's your understanding of how one would begin to correlate a relationship from what's happening in the celestial realm? I can understand how those implications would flow through to the planet and to things like weather systems and more like naturally occurring experiences in the material dimension. How do you correlate the link between what's happening in the celestial macrocosm to the psychological microcosm.
In an individual, are you talking about?
Yes.
So in an individual, we all have what's known as a birth chart, a natal chart. And the natal chart will show us exactly what's coming over the horizon at the time of a person's birth and where the planets are located. And this provides for us kind of a window to the skies. So I may have a Jyotish chart. Do you have a Jyotish chart to show? Just
I have the one that you did for me. So if you're watching on YouTube, you can look at this. It kind of looks almost like an Argyle-y pattern.
Yeah. So that's a window to the sky at the time that Scott was born. And that diamond on the top is the eastern horizon. What's rising on the eastern horizon? Everything to the right side of his chart is what's visible mostly is what's visible in the sky at the time of his birth. So Scott was born pretty early in the day. So those planets on the right side of the chart would not be seen by the naked eye, but they were all above the horizon at the time of his birth. So the placement of the planets, the association of other planets, and also the lunar mansions that the planets are placed in, all have it's a destiny pattern for a person. Of course, we have our free will. What we do with those proclivities, as you said, what we do with those energies that are present for us, we have our choices. But there are, you know, this chart shows us our firm karmas, our not firm karmas, and our mixed firm and unfirm karmas. Knowing these things, we can kind of make those nature or nurture. What was the word you said before? Nature or natural
or normal. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Make those choices based on the karmas, indications of what focus in life, which of the four purusharthas were more, we have more of a propensity for.
Can you define purusharthas for our listeners?
Sure. There's four of them, and they're the aims of life. So we have dharma as the first purusharta, which of course is kind of a cornerstone for all the purusharthas, because it's about doing things the right way, doing things with heart, with intention, with the good of everyone and everything. So dharma is the path that, you know, hopefully we all have that, you know, dharmic bent, but some of us are more inclined to have artha as our theme of life, which is more the gathering of resources, the working, the making money, the all the material aspects of survival. Some of us, our path is more on that way. Then we have kama, which is the enjoyment of life, and some people are just kama, more kama bent in their life. And then the last one is moksha, and moksha is the path of freedom and liberation. So each of us has one or two of these areas of life that are our focus.
It's really interesting. So I'm really getting a sense of this mixture of like the karma of the soul journey, and mixing it with it, I'll just kind of say it this way, like the karma of the planets and the celestial bodies and what they represent, this window into what the sky is up to and how the intersection of those two things creates a particular confluence that starts to create not a closed destiny around you, but certain influences that may flavor the experience that you're having to do with what you will, which would then create more of these potential karmas.
Exactly. Exactly. They're potentialities.
Got it. Okay. So if we could understand for somebody that might have a hard time creating the link where, so this is what the skies are up to at the moment of birth. Could we give an example of like how it is that like by what currency does that extend itself into these potentials or proclivities of an individual? Is it vibration? Is it, how do we make the linkage? Is it beyond our pay grade? Like
kind of all of those things. Yeah. It's, you know, I would say of course vibrational, but it's energetic. Mm. Energetic would be more the way that I would describe it. Those energies are present at the time of your birth that then kind of give that predisposition or themes to be prominent in the life.
So that's so fascinating because it's like even as like little ones, then there's these little almost like seeds that maybe haven't like cracked open, taken root, but it might be that like as we encounter those forces in the natural world, we might feel drawn to or repelled by them.
Yep. Well, the theory is, you know, we kind of have a little bit of a hand in this in planning this play that we're in. Our cups are almost alike.
Look at that. Cheers.
Planning this play that we're in, we've written the script, we've chosen the actors, and we have our karmic lessons and our karma to burn in this life. We have our stuff to figure out.
Can you say more about that? I've always been curious. I think this might be like the origin of my, at least spiritual journey, at least in this incarnation. I can remember being a kid and just being obsessed with like what came before this, what comes after this, and what is concurrent with this, but not here, like beyond what I can see, but present, this like substrate or backdrop. But our sort of, yeah, what's your perception on what is soul and what is soul's capacity to, like you said, have a hand in this incarnation?
Of course, we'll never know, right? We will never know, we think we probably will never know. But my own interpretation from the studying that I've done with my teachers is that this soul is on journey after journey, body after body, energy never dying, of course. And I have to think that there's more of a purpose than just existing and, you know, buying shoes.
I typed into Google yoga, and then when I hit the space, you know how it does like the suggestive things based on whatever's trending,
right?
The first one that came up was pants.
Right. I don't think that that's my purpose.
No.
But you know, we are here to enjoy life, dharmically. So, you know, I do think that our chart, from my experience in my several years of study, it's incredible to me how accurate people's charts, when I sit with somebody or even my own chart, how accurate those energies play out in a person's life.
You know, I think that's one of the ways that we can acts as validation is being that like curious skeptic that's like, okay, well, it's not provable by the accepted instruments of science. So let's put that out there, right? Because it's speaking about something that is metaphysical. It's bigger than physical. So if we try to measure it with the physical, it's not going to be able to be confirmed by those instruments. But then we're limiting our, not only our knowledge, but our understanding and our experience to the limitations of those instruments. So then we have to enter into a new form of, in the Indian teachings, what would be called an authoritative testimony or a direct experience. Yeah. There's all these different versions of how we come into to validation or proof. And that one is a really powerful one because it allows us to say, well, let's try it on. Let's, you know, have the willing suspension of disbelief in order to try it on. And then let's see where it takes us. Does it prove true? Does it not prove true? Is it resonant? Is it not resonant? Is it helpful? Is it not helpful in our journey? And then you start to go, well, man, you know, I think something like 80% of people in India and Nepal utilize Ayurveda as part of their system of health. That there are hospitals where the protocols are Ayurvedic based. There are medical schools that teach Ayurveda. And in terms of Jyotish, there are universities in India that give advanced degrees in this. Yes. So while our culture maybe hasn't accepted it to that level of degree, no pun intended, there is acceptance. And I can't imagine that those institutions, I'm not a big fan of, I have a definitely anti-authoritarian streak in me. But given that, when I see an institution accept something, a good example would be all of the insurance companies in the United States of America accepting acupuncture as a treatment that they'll cover. And I'm like, wait, hold up. That's based on meridians. So the only way they would actually do that is if the proof is in the pudding, so to speak. So you've been in the trenches working with human beings in understanding and their chart. And then, and so I guess my next question would be, can we break it down a little bit closer? Let's say you hooked me and I'm like, okay, I'm going to suspend the disbelief. So can you help me put a little bit of like intellectual scaffolding around this idea? So there's these like diamonds, like in this chart. Can you help, like, for the layman and especially without the visual, if somebody's listening only to the audio of this podcast, if you were to break down in simple terms the structure of Vedic astrology, houses, signs, etc., what are some of the core concepts that would help us land ourselves here?
So the core concepts, the sky, the birth chart is a picture of the sky, a window of the sky. And as I mentioned, what's on the very top of the chart in the North Indian chart is what we're looking at. A South Indian chart is a different whole structure. North Indian chart, that top diamond is what's coming over the horizon at the birth. So what's coming over the horizon at the birth, there's a constellation. That constellation is called a Rashi. So in your chart, for anybody who is watching, can see that Scott has a number 4 on that top diamond. And it's in the lower corner here. And the AS means the ascendant. So that's the rising degree coming over the horizon. So the 4 stands for the constellation or Rashi of Cancer. So the energies associated with Cancer would be salient in Scott's life, in his core being. each one of these diamonds and triangles on the chart represents different areas of life. And they each have one of these constellations. So again, the energies of those particular constellations would have the themes of those would be important in the themes of that area of life. Each one of these constellations, Rashis, is owned by a planet. And in Jyotish, we call planets grahas. And grahas mean the Caesars. So if the word doesn't mean planet, they grab you. So each one of these constellations has a planet that owns it. And each one of these planets goes to a certain house on the chart. The energy of those grahas, those planets, in the theme of the house that they're in, plus the energies of the constellation that is there, all factor together in starting to make a storyline for a person's life. Where are the proclivities, where are the energies, where the focuses may be, where there may be auspiciousness, where there may be inauspiciousness, where there may be just a natural luck that happens, a natural talent. Also depicted on the chart are the key people in a person's life. They're represented by different houses and different planets. And in addition to that, we have in our different periods of life, and it's different for everybody, there's a ruling planet at the time of your life, and that will also govern at that point in your life what could be going on for you. Another point is that the planets, the grahas, have influences on each other and can affect positively, negatively, how these things play out.
So the interrelationship amongst all these different forces and factors creates a unique outpicturing called us in a way.
Exactly. And even, I get all the time, well, what if someone is born exactly at the same time in the same state? It's still, there are so many themes to each graha, so each house called a bhava. The houses are the bhavas, that the interpretation for each person is different. And there's also, and just looking at a natal chart in and of itself is just, one slice. There are divisional charts that, are also calculated and give us more specific information about specific areas of life. Again, the planet that's ruling at the time, which that can change. If someone is born within a minute of another person that I mentioned, that can completely be a different picture.
Yeah, so, not to mention your understanding and the way you articulated the nature of soul going from body to body to body as if it was like a person changing outfits day after day after day, but on a macro scale. And that's only within one dimension of time, right? That's just within past, present, future linear expression of time. So, and assuming that a soul could only incarnate in one body at a time. And I mean, there's so many things, but just if we even stayed with superimposing our own chronological nature of time onto this thing that is also potentially outside of space, and then therefore would be outside of that expression of time, since that's space time.
Well,
yeah, let me say that again and slow down. So yeah, like if we're something beyond this spatial material expression of self, and space and time are one, then we would then be transcending not only the spatial body, but the ephemeral or time body as well. But what I think what we tend to do is project our notions of linear time onto soul. And not to say that that's not an aspect potentially of soul. I'm just ruminating here off the cuff, but if it were even that, we would have gone through so many of these Vedic charts every time we took another body. And if the idea of cause and effect or the accumulation of past experience is present in these incarnations, which is the idea of, like, in many traditions, what incarnates is the accumulation of our karma. And so therefore you blend what's happening in the sky with the historical aggregate of this karma, and it's going to be different, right? If I put olive oil and I pour it into balsamic, it's going to be different than if I just pour it into, salad dressing, you know, whatever, ranch, you know, it's going to, so you've got two things coming together at least. And so it would have to create something different, even if you were born at the same time.
Exactly. You're bringing all the other stuff. It's an amalgamation.
It's an amalgamation, 100%. And another way of saying it is you're the amalgamation.
Exactly.
Like, wow. Like, boom. And then if that's true, it's not only, if we were to then really let our minds open for a moment here and consider that maybe it's not just the linear chronological time that we're moving through, but really that time is moving through us. When I say us, I mean soul us, not incarnate us. And maybe what's happening is you're standing at the intersection of the world of form and the world of formlessness. And that it's like you're standing in the Big Bang. Because when we try to look at the Big Bang, I mean, it does break down. It's not really talk about instrumentations falling short and then calling it science. Science does not confirm that the Big Bang is the origin of the universe. Science breaks down at what we call the Big Bang, because that's where instrumentation dies off. And so it brings me to this question of, you know, you said earlier that souls are deathless. Energy doesn't die, right? We're talking about the currency of energy here, which would bring up for me the idea that it probably is birthless as well. And if something is without ending and it's not subject to the confines of time in the linear sense, that I like, yeah. For our listeners, that thumb just popped up. Like, yeah, you're onto something, guys. AI is tripping. Then if it's birthless, then like, are souls even born? Like, how does that happen? Right. If we were to take out the idea of origin and cessation, then everything just is. And yet there's this movement, this proliferation happening. And so that's the idea, I think, of like Brahman in Indian terms, like this sort of like seed point of like the totality of all that is, that doesn't begin, doesn't end, always is. And you are that. It's like, wow, that's really cool. I mean,
Yep, we are not born, we don't die.
So steering us back into this current of we come into this world, this is what's happening in the structure of the cosmos. It's embedding us with particular potentialities, and then we enter into the stream of life. What we know so far from the experience of this system lasting for thousands of years, and you as our testimony provider, from being on the ground working with people and seeing it show up in ways that confirm its validity. If somebody was listening to this and they were like, okay, how do I figure this out? And how do I take it from interesting conversation to practical application, what would you suggest they do?
Well, you have to experience it to make your own judgment. So go get a Jyotish reading, go sit with the Jyotishi and see what,
well, listen, they're not on every corner. I'm lucky. You live down the street. So where does one go to find this? Are there online resources? Where's a good starting point we can direct people towards?
There's some wonderful books, of course. David Frawley has written a lot of wonderful books. That my teacher's teacher, Hart Defoe, has written Light on Life, which is probably the most authoritative book. And maybe I'm saying that from a bias, but in our lineage, that's kind of the Bible. There is, of course, Shastra, which is, you know, the old texts. that may be a little bit hard for a beginner to really dig into. So someone just wanting to learn about this, I wouldn't direct you there, you know, immediately. There's tons of great books, and I would probably go with the reading rather than looking online for too much, because there's so many crazy opinions out there. My teacher is always warning us about not relying on, you know, what we find out on the internet and staying kind of pure about what we're learning.
Yeah, it's fascinating. One of the systems that I've had a similar experience with, like, just eye-opening, wow, this has been so helpful in my journey, has been Enneagram. And I look forward to a future episode about that. But there's so much out there now where it's gotten cheapened, commercialized, popularized, and not all sources are good sources.
Yeah.
So I know you don't like to self-promote or anything, nor is that like the purpose of this podcast, but it's also not to restrict from access. I'm curious if you do like telesessions or you only work with people locally.
I work with most people via Zoom.
Okay, cool. So that's a resource right there for people that feel resonant with you.
I want to, yeah.
How do we, I guess I want to backtrack this beginning of the sentence here. I had an experience once that this is what it like genuinely opened me to this, and it's going to be out there. So like caveat, disclaimer, all the things, like proceed at your own discernment here, because it's going to be a little esoteric for a moment. Not that we didn't already like completely jump through that, but here we go. It's funny because you should never do this. If you're a podcaster, don't ever read the comments on the YouTube and everything. But I was reading some of them on our like RFK podcast, and somebody said, you got to like drop all the new age diarrhea at the beginning. And there's so many woke words like acknowledgement and trauma. I was like, woof, I don't know, man. I mean, I'm not like the uber woke person. I have my critiques, but I think we need to acknowledge trauma if we're going to have a real conversation. So it's cool. We're all in different spaces with it. Don't read the comments. But anyway, here we go. It's going to be the uber version of that. But this is a true story, Mary, and to our listeners. I wake up one morning. It's probably, I don't know, like one of those early morning, like you wake up almost in the middle of the night, but it's close to the morning, like 4 to 5 a.m. kind of things. And I hear what feels like it's inside of a empty hollow that I saw visually, but internally was black, just all black and really clear, empty. And the only thing, like, so the idea is like I was not in a busy dream. Let me say that. I was not in like a story of any sort, just totally like I'm dropped into some deep, profound meditation in some like archaic, like cave somewhere. And I just hear in almost like echoing through the cave walls. And this is distinctly an Indian man's voice going, Ishta Devata, Ishta Devata, Ishta Devata, Ishta Devata. And it's just repeating, like it is on repeat enough till it like brings me like into like wakefulness. I sit up and in an Indian accent, I go, Ishta Devata. And I'm like, what the heck was that? It was like the wild, I literally sat up in my bed and I heard, and I'm like jarred out of sleep. And I'm like, what did I just, I don't even know these words. I've not heard these words before. And I obviously have some affinities probably in my chart towards Indian teachings. I've studied a lot, but I have not come across this particular combination of words. So I, of course, you know, do what everybody would do and like turn to Google and type in, maybe I'm going to a bad source here, going on what you just said. But I don't have any books and I don't have any resources and I don't even know what this word means. So I just want to look up the word, and it tells me that there are particular deities and particular mantras, or not even like full-on chants, but like what are called bija mantras, like seed vibrations that the universe is echoing out at the moment of your birth. And that will feel like a resonance to you that can that if you were to chant it as a practice, even internally and silently, recalibrate you to that air quotes natural state of what feels like home to your soul level prior to all the air quotes normal. And I was like, wow, I need to like find this. And that's how I came across Jyotish. And I'd already been studying yoga before, but hadn't turned over that stone. So what's your take on that story and on Ishta Devata? And is that something that you do support people in connecting to what that birth mantra might be, or would that be in a different lineage?
I have not formally yet studied Ishta Devata, but from what I know of it, first of all, what I make of your dream is to find your Ishta Devata. Duh. Right?
I mean, come on, right? We're not going to not do that after that kind of an experience. Yeah.
So from, I believe, nobody quote me on this, although I'm quoting myself on it right now, that the Ishta Devata has to do with the deity of your, where your moon is placed.
Mm-hmm. So we'll have to look it up and see.
And there are syllables that are associated with that deity. I think it's where your lunar nakshatra is, as a matter of fact. Which is the lunar mansion that I mentioned earlier, which is in India, Vedic astrology, it's all about the moon. The moon is you know, really, really significant in the marker for a native. So, so that Ishta Devata is finding who that deity is, the seed, the bija mantra, and to practice that's your focal point of let's use the word worship.
Beautiful. I love the inclusion of that devotional quality or property. And so that could look like if I'm sitting down for my morning meditation practice, which I like to do, and we're going to get into daily rituals in a little bit, but maybe my meditation is centered on that, or maybe just includes that for a little while. I use mine as almost like an on-ramp sometimes. And then so kind of similar to like the Vedic meditation or TM styles of like wearing it loosely and not tightening focus on it, but letting it just sort of percolate in the consciousness. A good friend of mine and meditation teacher, hopefully have on here one day, Matt Cardone, teaches it like if because it's natural, we find it charming, and that allure sort of pulls us towards it. So we don't need to tighten our focus around something that has a deep resonance. And you know, and he describes it like you go to a party, you know, and imagine like you and your beloved are go to a party together, but then you sort of drift away from one another, and you're talking to someone on one side of the room, and they're these things. If you're on YouTube, I just had the explosion. This is hilarious right now. Your beloved is on the other side of the room, the fireworks are going off, and you kind of, you're maybe mid conversation with somebody, but you know, or maybe you're between and your eyes wander, and you kind of check, hey, where are they, you know? Oh, I see, okay, I got you. And you come and you go with it, but it never really leaves. And there's a certain sense of like, hey, where's that at? So we're chanting it, mind drifts, and it comes back, and that's okay.
Yep. I love that. That Ishta Devata kind of becomes your go-to anchor.
Mm-hmm. So I think many of our listeners and viewers are going to probably feel historically, if I had to paint a broad brushstroke, if they're open to this conversation, probably have a background, more familiarity with Western astrology. How would you speak to somebody coming from that orientation to this orientation? Is there a confluence? Is there are they in disagreement? How can one bridge the gap or maybe allow them to coexist?
Yeah. So in my education, it's never been presented as a disagreement. It's just two different systems altogether. And they're of many, many systems. It's not just Vedic astrology and Western astrology. There's so many cultures with astrology as their way of divination. So the difference between the two on a why are they different? What is the calculation? The calculation is different. So for example, I've been a Scorpio in Western astrology my whole life. And I think a lot of the qualities that are described as Scorpio, at least the ones that Cosmo always said, I thought, wow, that's so me. That's wild. And when I went to my first Vedic astrology class, P.S., by complete accident, I didn't really seek this out. This just kind of found me. I learned in the very first class that in Vedic astrology, my sun is not in Scorpio, it's in Libra. So that kind of blew my mind. And why is that? And that's because there's a calculation difference. So about every 26,000 years, the Earth does a little wobble. And well, it's a wobble that takes 26,000 years where the sun and the planets all travel. It shifts a little bit. So it's 1 degree every 72 years. So it's shifted the calculation. So in Western astrology, it's got its always starting point at the vernal equinox. Aries is the first constellation, and it's right at the vernal equinox. And Vedic astrology is sidereal astrology. So it's exactly where the planets are placed in the sky versus this fixed system that Western astrology uses.
So it accommodates for, is that like the precession?
Precession. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, accommodates for precession.
Got you. So
I know that word. Wow.
Hey, listen, I am like a little bit of a junkie for astronomy, mm-hmm. For space exploration and understanding some of this stuff. It's kind of why it's fascinating because, in fact, in a couple of weeks, we'll be recording an episode with the gentleman who trains the astronauts for is it Blue Origin, Blue Horizon, what's it called? The space company that Jeff Bezos started. And so it's kind of like the SpaceX, private space exploration. And he's a rocket scientist. And when the astronauts are in outer space and they're communicating back down to Earth, they're communicating with him and really excited to get into that. So that's always been a love of mine. It was like the idea of like colonization and like other consciousness is in space and how they could be interacting here. And so bringing those two things together through this conversation is really fascinating for me. So I appreciate the, you know, willingness to dive into all of this. So the accuracy or of the system is really sitting on it's accounting for some of these variables, and that might be where some of the differences in style might be, but ultimately not to invalidate other systems. It's almost like different practices or styles of yoga or meditation. It's just different ways of coming into understanding something.
And the idea for all of them is to help people live better. So, you know, if it helps, yay. The other difference between the two systems, Western astrology is very sun-based. That, you know, I am a Scorpio, I am a Libra, is based on the sun, and the sun is kind of the center of Western astrology, which I have never studied. And in Eastern Vedic astrology, the ascendant and the moon play a little bit of a bigger role. The sun is still, you know, obviously every, and that's the other difference that I think is that every planet in a Vedic chart has, you know, is looked at, has, you know, extreme importance in, not to say that it's not in Western astrology that way, but the pop culture part of Western astrology is all about where is your sun? What's your sun? Yeah. What's your sun sign? What's your sign? We don't really have that parallel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can definitely see that it's at least the way in which, in common parlance, it's much more myopic in that there's, you know, look up your sign and how the impact of the astronomical changes of the current moment are impacting your sign. And I did notice that, you know, taking in what you shared, there's all of these different elements that are all part of us, and the sun, the moon, all the different planets. There was like other things I never heard of, like
the nodes,
so wild.
Yeah,
it's like a whole other language of like understanding how what's happening in the macrocosm is informing our experience of the microcosm of ourselves, and why. Now, if when we talk about healing the divide, I think one way to say this is if we were to really ascribe to the notion of non-duality, which would be the opposite of a divide, then we would see all of life, all of existence as a continuum of a spectrum of vibration of one thing. In a similar way that like a muscle becomes a tendon, becomes a bone, we don't have a muscle and a tendon and a bone. We have one tissue that shapeshifts according to various densities of frequency. And then we expanded that not just to be the environment of this particular planet to which we have a physical gravitational connection to, but if we understand that the moon is gravitationally connected as well, and that we're all orbiting around the sun, and that's one of many, at least, and you start to extend the fabric of self wider to include a non-dual tapestry of the whole, and the understanding that if you affect any one aspect or any one aspect is impacted in a particular way, it would then express itself out through that totality, which includes you, then from that standpoint, it starts to not feel illogical or irrational, maybe transrational, that it challenges our rationality and our like typical conventional ways of thinking things, but not particularly pre-rational. But it's interesting because it has its origins in ancient times where we might say, hey, that's pseudoscience. Hey, that's pre-rational. But it is also, as I understand, like evolved over time as well. And so, yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
They're living sciences. So that's why, you know, we're still practicing them today. They're, you know, they grow to change with us, with our world, with our civilization, with our relationship with the earth, with the skies, with each other.
It's so amazing. It expands the sense of selfhood. Even as I'm sitting here in this moment, taking this conversation in, and the parts of me psychologically that might get defensive or feel threatened or project, and like all these things that feel susceptible to harm or loss, when we realize what we truly are in the deepest sense, that it is unthreatenable and it is fundamentally secure and I think it's in the recognition of that, that our dharma is clarified, our kama like is given space. When we say kama again, meaning joy, desire, like we're freed up to experience the fullness of life when we're not so encumbered by false identification with the more, maybe again, normal, air quotes, normative aspects of the human condition. So this said, if we could move the conversation in the second half here to Ayurveda.
Okay, I'm going to give you a good segue for that. And that is that in the Jyotish chart, we can often identify dosha, which is the constitution of a person, physical constitution, and also physical tendencies, disease tendencies that can be in a person, birth traumas, things that are in, you know, the life, the physical life of a person. So that being said, as an Ayurvedic practitioner, I use the Jyotish chart with my clients, consulting with my clients to see what's going on, what can be going on with the health, what clues can I get to understand their prakriti? What phase of life are they in right now? Mentally, where their strengths and weaknesses could be, what their family relationships might look like, what their work satisfaction might be, to, you know, help me help themselves and heal themselves.
Can you define for our listeners who may not be familiar, the term you just used, prakriti?
The prakriti, thank you, is our constitution that we came in this body to have. So should I go into the whole premise of Ayurveda? Is that our
I think this would be a great way to start to give the backdrop of what Ayurveda is. I'll pick it up from there.
Okay. So yes, the prakriti is our constitution, that, you know, the stuff that we're made of, the balance of the five great elements, ether, air, fire, water, and earth. And each of us has our own little blueprint that we're born with based on our genetics, based on the lifestyle and exposures of the mother, and based on the season at which we were conceived. So we
got it.
Our special blend of who, you know, who in this body we are.
Okay, so it's incarnation specific to some degree of like the this, what's in the substrate of
Ayurveda is more so. Yoga is the mind practice. Ayurveda is the body, sister science relating to that body.
So this would be medical in nature.
Yes, it is.
Okay, and then I've heard you describe the to balance our understanding of what's present in prakriti with the idea of vikriti. Could you define what vikriti is, and then we can start to put these two things together?
Yeah, vikriti is the current state of a person. So we have all of these influences that change the elemental balance in a person. So those could be the foods we eat, the experiences we have, the people around us, the season, the time of life that we're in, the time of day. All of these different influences create a vikriti, or a present state, which is constantly in flux. It's constantly moving based on what we're doing.
So the prakriti is like the embed.
It's the ground zero, yeah.
Ground zero, thank you. And the vikriti is the present moment experience that we're having, which is, it's like fluctuating always. I'm imagining like a sound engineer taking those modulation dials and being like, oh, we need a little bit more bass, lower the treble, you know, more to the left, you know, and that kind of an experience of like, so we've got like our Jyotish informing our Prakriti, and we put some words together here, and then in mixture, you know, with all of any previous karmas in yoga, it's called Parabdha karma, or accumulation of past karmas. And so now that's all commingling, and we're now interacting with present moment experiences, one another, circumstances, different emotions, thoughts, but also what the weather systems are doing, the time of day, the season that we're in. And so there's this like wild confluence of factors that are interacting and cross-pollinating with each other. And we are implored not to find some static solution, but kind of like the Vedic astrology, accommodating for the pre-sessions, accommodating for the, you know, air quotes, pre-sessions of day-to-day life, for the wobble of being human. And how do we become both the participant and the observer, that sound engineer?
Someone like that. Well, too, that was just a perfect time together.
Yeah, so we were the participatory observer in having like witness consciousness and engagement. We're not trying to be hermits living in a cave, meditating away. We are householders, right? We're in the world, we're doing our thing. And for most of us here that are probably tuning into the pod are living in the United States of America. And of course, that is really, you know, based in consumerism and identification with the material life. And so to start to open up to these aspects of consciousness while not turning away from the material life, but to stay engaged with it, is the razor's edge practice. And so as we can tune more into a greater sense of refinement with these aspects of our constitution in the experiential application, I would imagine, empowers us to live a more fulfilling, aligned, balanced, meaningful life.
That's what all these arts and sciences are about. That's the purpose for them. Hmm.
Okay, so let's dial it in. So someone's listening to the podcast and they're going, okay, interesting. I want to explore this a little bit. So first step in Ayurveda, let's say like I call up Mary Consort and I say, okay, where do we begin?
We begin at the beginning. We begin with the Prakriti. So understanding what our Prakriti is can give us an indication of what things we have to watch out for. So the Prakriti of a person is called their dosha. And the dosha is what that special blend of elements is for an individual. The word dosha in Sanskrit means fault. So actually a dosha, rather than again, this is another time to be wary about what you learn on the internet or what you read on the internet, because it's kind of like, what's your dosha thing? It's your dosha is where your flaws, where your faults are, what your disease propensity is.
Mm. So I almost heard it like a fault line.
Yeah.
Like, not putting the psychological overlay, but there's just like a crack in the natural thing. And yeah, I don't know how that lands for you, but I do see that in Enneagram. People will go, I'm a 9, I'm a 4. And it's like, no, that's what you're not. That's what's gone out of,
right.
You know, essence. Right. You say personality constricts essence, but essence informs personality. And so it's like, it's kind of telling you what you're not,
right.
Or where you diverge from self.
Or where you can, anyway, where there's a little bit more for the bucket to spill over.
Well said. Thank you.
Everybody is all the elements, because if we don't have them, we don't function as a body. So to just break that down, ether and air combined make the dosha called vata, which is the wind element, the movement principle in the body and the mind. Mm. Ayurveda, body and mind are interconnected, can never be separated. What happens in one happens in the other. So we're speaking about the whole being. The fire and water combination make the Pitta dosha. And that's the principle of metabolism, of transformation. So all the processes in the body are governed by Pitta. So just to backtrack, if we don't have Vata in the body, there's no movement of anything. So we all have Vata. If we don't have Pitta, we have no processes happening. We all have Pitta. And the third dosha is called Kapha. And that's the water and air combination. And that is the structure. We all have a structure. So someone who has more Vata in them, who has a Vata property, is going to be someone with more of this movement and space in their being. Someone with more Pitta predominant, is going to be someone with more fire, more higher metabolism, more passion. Someone with more Kapha is going to be a solid, someone with mostly structure. So it's important to understand that if someone, you know, understands what their dosha is, they're understanding that that's the dosha is the fault. The prakriti is the combination. The dosha is, you know, I'm Vata. So that means that Vata diseases will be the first column, that if I go out of balance, that's where I'm probably going to have the problem, is in Vata diseases. Same with Pitta, same with Kapha. But the prakriti is that balance of all of the elements, all the doshas.
Got it. Okay. So that's like the whole mixture of it all is the prakriti. And then within that, you've got the respective doshas. Can I ask a few questions about doshas and diving in, or did you want to layer in another piece?
No, I think it's a good stopping point.
Okay. Yeah, thank you so much for the clarity and breaking down the three doshas that, again, to mirror back something and draw out, this is where if we're most likely to tend or towards moving out of balance, and where we would first see it in our system. So if we were in like the diagnostics of it, we would look for particular trends in our behavior and or in our what's actually manifesting in our bodies as well. So so the Vata dosha, it governs movement, and then the Pitta dosha governs process, and those are landing like a little synonymous for me. I'm having a hard time maybe identifying the distinction. Could you flesh that out a little bit?
Yeah. So think of more the Pitta being more of the chemical process, the Vata being more of the kinetic, of the kinesis. So the Pitta being more like metabolism, digestion, processing of thoughts, and where Vata mentally would be more just the movement of thoughts, not so much of the interpreting.
Understand. That's very helpful. Yes. Okay. So Pitta has this more of this alchemical metabolizing quality to it.
Yes.
Okay. That's really, really helpful. Thank you. And then, yeah, kinetic is a great word to help me understand Vata. So Pitta would be like, maybe like I'm using Pitta to like really chew on what, like mentally, like it's like where I'm like really chewing on what you're saying and trying to understand it.
Okay, let's say digesting. Vata is more the chewing.
Vata, okay.
More the chewing, and Pitta is the digesting.
Got it. Okay. So super helpful. So if somebody has more Vata in their nature mentally versus Pitta mentally, can you describe how that would discern? I want to just like really put this into place.
And of course, just like you mentioned earlier when we were talking about Jyotish, these are not things that we can, you know, take somebody and do an exploratory surgery and find or look under a microscope and see. We're again talking about energies at work in a person. So the air and space element in the mind acts like either someone who has a spacey kind of mind, someone who has maybe not the greatest focus, but they may be bursting with ideas and creativity. They may, because their minds are so active, they may talk a lot. They may talk quickly. They may change topics. I have a hard time staying on course. A Vata mind with too much Vata might be more anxious and worried. Whereas a Pitta person is a very intense, kind of sharp-minded person. They're very goal-oriented. They're hyper-focusers. They are hard to turn off. They're the people who will, you know, most likely burn out from overdoing, overthinking, overworking. Overthinking in a different way than a Vata overthinker. So I'm kind of anticipating your question there. A Vata overthinker is more of a ruminating kind of a thinking, whereas a Pitta is a focused, direct planner. Pittas are your list keepers. They're organized for everything at all times. Very, just a sharp, that the word that I would describe for a Pitta, because a quality, a guna of Pitta is tikshna, which is sharpness.
Okay. Yeah, I'm imagining this sort of like a cone narrowing in on and like really, yeah, dialing in, focused, on point, sharp. And the Vata feels a little bit more aloof. Is that the right word?
I wouldn't say aloof. I would say more all over the place.
Scattered?
Sometimes vacuous. Yeah, scattered would be the word. Sometimes vacuous. Often scattered, but in a balanced Vata person is a, you know, very creative mind, is a very fluid kind of, maybe fluid's not the right word because it's not a watery thing, but, active, creative, lively.
Mm-hmm. I could see the balanced expression of that really being a beautiful place to source creativity, because it feels really open. It's like the distinction between spacious and spacey. It's a thin line. It could go either way, right?
That is a balanced Vata may be spacious, and an imbalanced Vata spacey.
And then if we were to go to Pitta, a balanced Pitta may be like resolute, but determined, but maybe like an imbalanced is rigid and burnt out.
Right. So we would say maybe focused and like intense, you know, intense to a, you know, a point that it's
a little too much.
Tending towards combustion.
Combustible. Okay. God. Yeah. No, we see that a lot. I think that's rampant in our culture.
It most certainly is. And that I would say is a, is not nature for a lot of people. It's a cultural influence.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Nature versus culture. Interesting context to side by side. Okay. And now Kapha.
Kapha mind out, because a Kapha mind is on the negative side. They can, I hate saying positive and negative, but that, let's say imbalanced Kapha can be really stubborn, immovable, too much structure, too much solidity, too much density. So stubborn, rigid, depressed, all that tamas. You know,
classic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Tamas, so you're referring to the guna or quality.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, okay. So with you, I can identify with, as you predicted, all aspects of everything you said. I can find in my nature all of these, and I can understand and appreciate deeply how they are interacting with one another, and how sometimes I can just get sucked into identification, not just like a conscious identification, but unconscious and energetic identification with them. And it informs things like, you know, my kid saying, hey, do you want to do this? And I'm too tired, you know, I don't have the energy to give to it. So maybe I combusted from too much pitta during the day. And so now my kapha feels excessive, and it feels like it's always dancing. And I'm just wondering, like, when we study imbalance in Ayurveda, is it kind of like how when I've studied the chakra system, like there you can be excessively imbalanced or deficiently imbalanced? And does that then start to become another dosha? Like if it is like not enough pitta necessarily, too much kapha? Is it like just this one spectrum and it's just, we just give it these names to call it something? Or is each one its own thing that could be excessive and deficient? Or am I thinking about it the wrong way?
Both. Yes and no. So yes, deficient, too much, and that's called vikriti. And that's what we look at for balancing someone and bringing them back closer to the property. So maybe when you burnt yourself out with your pitta and you were too tired the next day from eating, you know, going home and eating a chocolate cake, you know, and then you had too much kapha in the morning. You understand what I'm, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's almost like they're just, I keep thinking of these waves, like one just becomes the next and they're shape shifting.
Yeah.
It's funny because I will find myself using like the unconscious mechanisms of, or unconscious expressions, I think, or healthy expressions of one of the other doshas to balance it out. So it's like, okay, to use the example I just gave. So like if I went like hard on work stuff all day, like, right, like we're opening a new studio, doing the podcast, having my coach clients, running the two different trainings simultaneously. And I have the pitta in me says, I can do all of it. Mm-hmm. Like I got this and, you know, and let's do it. And then I get home and like the first thing that I want to do is like, just like sit on the couch and like go to like an excess, like an kapha move, if you will, to try to balance the excess pitta.
Yeah.
And, well, and so I'm wondering if you see those kind of tendencies.
We have a little lag here.
How you might support someone, you know, yeah, asking for a friend.
Yeah, we just had a little lag there, but I think I heard everything that you said. We just had one of those things. So because you have so much kapha in your property, it's what gives you the stamina to, you know, for that burst of pitta.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, somebody who had more vata might really not have the endurance for doing what you're doing.
Interesting.
But yes, there is an innate, we're healers. We heal ourselves. There's an innate knowledge that, you know, when one dosha is going through the roof, that you're going to make a choice to balance it if you're aware. Some people who are high pitta, they're going to go and they're going to go home and have a drink and they're going to keep the pitta going, you know, versus rest and bring the kapha up.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's that, like increases like, opposites balance theory. Okay. In Ayurveda.
Very fascinating to me. So let's support some people that are tuning in. I know we can't like do deep dives, but can, and I know there's also this mixture of like, we can be, you know, you have to have two doshas that are dominant or two that are close and all three. But let's just, for simplicity's sake, even if it only under like supports clarification of the concepts, mm-hmm. could we do a run through of if you're like a day in the life of being predominant in each dosha, and how you might offer the 30,000 foot view version of sustenance and balance and good health for each one. Okay. Maybe looking at like a clock, and it's, you know, we can start whether we want to start at like wake up time or whatever. However you take this.
So we can start with the clock. Sure. So in the morning, we all typically wake up somewhere between the vata time of day and the kapha time of day. So the kapha time of day is from 6 to 10 a.m. The vata time of day is from 2 to 6 a.m. So the qualities of vata between 2 and 6 a.m., there is more movement. Ayurveda suggests that we try to get up during that vata time of day, because the next juncture, the 6 to 10 slot, is kapha time of day. So we may not get up and be energetic. Sleeping into that past 6 a.m., the later we sleep into that, the more it's a kapha time. Those qualities of kapha, those slow and heavy qualities of kapha, are in the atmosphere. Think of the dew on the grass and the leaves. All that moisture, denseness, heaviness is there. So if we let ourselves sleep into that time, we're going to be prone to having more kapha in the system. So we try to get up, especially if you're a kapha person, to get up before that time of day.
Okay. That feels really big for, I mean, if you get nothing else from this podcast, don't get up between 6 a.m. and 10 a.m. according to Ayurveda. I know that I appreciate your approach to teaching this, which is like not being so rigid and like, you must do this and like, you right. know, so, but the goal would be to not wake up during the time when kapha is more present, because you might be more tired, if I'm understanding this correctly, at 7 a.m. than you would be at 5 a.m.
Yes, I think that most people can think of that in their life experience and relate to that, that the later you sleep, the harder it is to get out of bed.
Yeah, I'm feeling so called out. Not that I'm like a late sleeper, but I could definitely go to like a 7:30 sometimes. But when I'll oftentimes wake up naturally at 5 and then just be like, let's go back to bed. But when I get up out of bed and I just push through that little bit of lip of resistance, I'm like, this is awesome. And like, I feel so great all day. And it's just breaking some of those habits. I do have a question while we're in this piece. Mm-hmm. When you were breaking down the doshas and you had talked about the property of water being present in both pitta and kapha. Mm-hmm. How is that and why is that and what's the distinction, if any?
Okay, so we have to think about it's fire and water together making pitta. So I would translate that to be more like bile.
Mm. So this gets to that alchemical...
Yeah, that hot, acidic kind of water. The kapha kind of water, I would think about more combining the earth and water and making like a clay-like substance. And of course, I mean, we're just completely putting physical, you know, and or phlegm, because these are the humors, wind, bile, and phlegm of, you know, classical philosophy. These are the humors. So that's where the water and fire together make pitta, acidity, hydrochloric acid in the belly, and kapha, the water mixed with the earth, makes a muddy, cloudy substance.
Wow. Thank you for that. That's super helpful. And again, checks out for me in terms of how I know my own constitution. So, okay, cool. So let's pick up with a day in the life.
Okay, so day in the life. So hopefully we're getting up around 6, and a little footnote on that, for those of you who meditate, 4 to 6 a.m. is a special time of day in the tradition, in Vedic tradition. It's Brahma Muhurta. It's like the time that we're closest to God, or whatever word you want to put in that space. It is a sacred time. It's the best time for meditation. So that's a little motivation for those of you who, you know, need a reason for getting up earlier. It's the best time for meditation. And it's a time when thinking about Vata and the atmosphere, it's an ethereal time. It's a time of clarity, because Vata is the dosha of clarity. It's clear. So that's the time for meditation, wake up time. So then we want to do some daily morning rituals that create an anchor for our lives, because really managing the doshas is about understanding what time of life we're in, what time of day we're in, what season we're in, and applying those things to our own being and being in harmony. So having a ritual helps keep us on track. So every morning, Ayurveda would ask us to please scrape our tongues with either a tongue scraper or a spoon, and just remove the digestive toxins, digestive residue that is left on the tongue, for ablutions like brushing the teeth, doing some oil swishing, oiling the nose and the ears. This protects us from the environment. It protects us from things coming in. Massaging the body with oil, doing some sort of exercise, and if we're hungry, eating breakfast. Before any food comes in, warm water lemon is a great way to start the morning, start the metabolism, start stimulating everything, preparing for food to come in. And yes, and then breakfast should be, if you're hungry, only, and a light breakfast, so that we can kind of ease into the day, ease the digestion. Ayurveda is all about digestion. It's pretty much the governing factor of our health. So shall I move on to the afternoon?
Yeah,
after breakfast, we're going to do our work. We're going to have our daily work. And at this point of the day, as kapha starts to come down around 10 a.m., the pitta starts to rise. And this is a very active time of day when pitta is alive and well. And we can get all of our stuff done. We can have a sharp mind. We can be industrious. And this is the best time for us to eat our largest meal of the day, because this is when our digestion is also at its most industrious. This is when our Agni, our digestive fire, is working its best, because it's got all that support of pitta. And so largest meal of the day, somewhere between 12 and 2 should be lunchtime. And then it's on to the afternoon activities. So we're going to start to see pitta come down around 2 and move up to the vata time. So again, we have the support of the atmosphere, all of this movement. And it's the time that we maybe have some creative bursts coming in the late afternoon, early into the evening. And it's also the time when we start to, you know, think about and prepare our dinner. So we have, you know, that little creative aspect coming into play as well. Dinner time should be as much as we can, again, before we get into the kapha time of day, because once kapha starts, then everything slows down, digestion slows down, everything just comes to a little bit of a halt. So eating the dinner time while it's still vata time will ensure that we're moving the food. Dinner should not be a heavy meal. Dinner should be lighter than lunch. And then evening activities, a little walk or some movement after dinner, because now we're in the kapha time again. We're in that stagnant, more stagnant kind of time. So some movement will help our digestion as we move into that time. And then the bedtime rituals, maybe rubbing some oil on the feet or taking a warm bath, winding down, and hoping to get into bed before 10 o'clock, before the kapha time has ended. Because if we stay up much later than that, we start cycling around to pitta time again, 10 to 2, 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. If we're active into that time of day, I'm sure everybody can relate to this, you get a second wind, and then it's really hard to shut down. So what Ayurveda is asking us to do is just to live in harmony with what's going on around us, to notice and be part of what's happening in nature.
So beautiful. Thank you for that depiction of a day. It's really powerful to consider it, trying it on. Just in my mind, as you were describing it, I really like the 10 to 6, and you still get 8 hours sleep. 10 feels late enough for, I'm just going to my like conditioned urges, you right. know, 10 feels late enough. 6 feels like early, but not too early. It doesn't feel like the ask is too big to take on. So 10 to 6 feels totally doable. And for my own nature, I don't know that 8 hours honestly serves me. Sometimes I do better with like 6.
Right.
And really taking that Brahma Muhurta and then going like, okay, I'm going to do 10 to 4, even 10 to 5 and get 7 hours and then really wake up with ease. Sometimes a question I had as I was trying it on is like, because I have probably a predominance of kapha, but like ketoing close behind is pitta and then vata. It's like, they're not too far away from one another, mm-hmm. but the, even though that if I wake up in those vata hours, meditation can feel maybe challenging because I don't have enough alertness that it's like feels almost too proximal to sleep. So I've realized if I'm going to meditate, a couple of things that are helpful for me is to get out of my bed and ideally to get outside. If I can sit out on the porch at that time of day, I can feel the elements that are present versus like being closed off in my house and not being able to feel that nature. And I'll always feel as soon as I go outside is the moment it kicks in and goes, ooh, this feels nice.
Yeah. You know,
and I'm grateful I have dogs. So like I take them out when I get up early, and that helps me wake up in a way that feels much more natural.
Yes. So one thing you mentioned that I wanted to bring out. So when we take into account our predominant dosha, how much sleep we need varies. So for a kapha person, you're absolutely on point that you don't need generally 8 hours of sleep.
Okay.
So sleep is something that makes kapha in our bodies. So kapha people, sorry to tell you, you're the ones who want to take a nap during the day, but it does not help you to take a nap. It will make you less energetic. The kapha person is the person who could stay up a little past into kapha time because they into pitta time because they need a little bit of that. They already have enough kapha. So a kapha person could be that one who stays up to 11 or 12 and still gets enough sleep and is able to shut down because they have the kapha in their constitution that enables them. A pitta person is going to be like, let me just do one more thing. Let me just do one more thing before I go to bed. Okay, one more thing on the list. I've got to get it done. And then I'm going to go to sleep. And then just that doesn't happen then until we're almost in the wee hours because that pitta just drives them.
So I think the broader takeaway is how our doshas interact with the like when those doshas as sort of more macro properties are present within nature. So what you described as that day in the life cycle, where are the variables that intervene? Is it like the type of oil, the type of food, et cetera?
Yes. So yes, types of food. People with a vata predominance are going to go to balance their vata. They're going to eat tastes that are sweet, salty, and sour as their predominant tastes. I think you're talking and I can't hear you. Scott, can you hear me? Okay. Is it on my screen? You're talking still. Okay. So vata is going to focus on the tastes of sweet, salty, and sour as the main tastes. Vata is going to, for balancing their dosha, look to eat things that are a little bit heavier with enough oils, warming oils like sesame, olive oil. They're going to reduce intake of raw foods, which have a lot of air and space element in them. They're very hard to digest. A vata digestion is generally a delicate digestion. And a pitta person is going to be focusing more on tastes of sweet, bitter, and astringent to help dry up that acidity and sweeten. And they too will be trying to eat more grounding foods that balance the qualities of fire and water. And then the kapha person is going to go for the lighter foods, going to go for the lighter, drier types of foods that are predominant in tastes of pungent, bitter, and astringent.
So how does one ascertain their predominant dosha?
There are many, many quizzes online that you can take to give you an idea. Sometimes you can just, you know, hearing the qualities, you kind of just know. There are physical aspects to the doshas that we can, you know, see. But it's important to understand that we're not just what we can see on the outside. We're, you know, we may have a predominant dosha that presents as our physical body, but our body processes can be more of another dosha, as can our emotional and mental property. It can be all three different, and they all together combine to make up what your, you know, the sum of them make up what your dosha is. That being said, if we're having a problem that is in the physical body, we're going to go to that dosha that we see first.
Okay.
A problem with the function of a body, we're going to go to that function, that dosha that we see first, etc.
Same would apply to, like, if you were working with, let's say, emotions.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the same thing with emotions. Sometimes I'll have a person who physically presents as a kapha person to me, but it's clear to me that emotionally the thing that's out of balance is vata, and that's what I'm going to focus on.
So interesting to really see that body, heart, mind, and which dosha might be predominant in different ones. Like, podcasting is great for my pitta because I can, like, really, you know, and for my vata, actually in my kapha, because the endurance of the long form, the movement which would be the kapha, the digestion of what's being shared and processing feels very pitta-y, and then moving through the conversation, I guess, feels vata-y to me, why I like it. But I'm also present to the fact that I'm not literally moving my physical body right now. So I'm in, like, more of an excess kapha when it comes to the physical aspect and I start to look at my day-to-day and my planning of it, I'm going, where am I moving my body today other than from like seat to car, you know? And I'm like concerned because I'm like, I don't know where that piece is. And I know I feel better when I can move some of that heavy cough out. And so this is fascinating and I'm using myself as an example, but the idea is to give an example. So if we're listening, to go back and go, well, what about me? And what about my dosha, which is such a common thing for us when we learn these things. I know you said to go online and look. I also heard you say like, there's like online can be tough for things. Is there certain resources that are connected to Ayurveda?
Sorry. Banyan Botanicals. Yeah. Banyan Botanicals has a nice all-purpose quiz. And also when you find out what your dosha is from Banyan Botanicals, they can get a lot of great recommendations for your dosha. I'm trying to think where else. You can contact me. I'll tell you what your dosha is.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I wanted to go there. I'm glad you brought them up because I had this on my list for you was once we get into treatment protocols, it seems like most things are plant-based, herbs, oils, plants, etc. I could be wrong because I'm, again, coming to this from the outside. But
Ayurveda is not necessarily plant-based. I mean, the plant medicine obviously is plant-based, but the concept is every substance is either medicine or poison for us.
I love that.
Sometimes I'm vegan, but sometimes in classical Ayurveda, meat is prescribed for someone who needs to put kapha on, who needs to build bulk. So, you know, there are many medications that have animal products in them that are part of classical Ayurveda. So it's not, it's decidedly not vegan. Ghee is celebrated substance in Ayurveda. It's used medicinally as well as in a culinary way. And honey as well, big medicine in Ayurveda.
So once somebody is able to establish what their predominant dosha is, and then they'll from that glean a deeper understanding of what where like increases like, and therefore maybe what to avoid if those things are coming out of balance, which would be the tendency, and then where we would want to go to the opposite in order to move towards balance. And then if we were to take that and put it into the framework of the daily ritual, the day in the life, we would work within the constructs that are present within nature and then choose the types of foods, also the types of practices, right? Could you speak a little bit about, let's say, working out, meditating, or yoga? How does dosha inform practices?
Sure. The dosha who benefits the most from strenuous physical activity, hold your ears, Scott, is kapha.
I already knew it.
So kapha needs the movement. Kapha needs the, because a lot of being kapha is stagnating. You know, there's that stillness. Things need to move. And so any physical activity is going to reduce kapha. So the kapha person has the endurance. They have usually the musculature if they're, you know, a lean type of kapha. They're the ones who are best suited for strenuous exercise. Pitta people are the ones who want to do the strenuous exercise. They're driven. They're the go-getters. And often they can, as everything else that Pitta is susceptible to, is overdoing it. And all of that fire can be wasting to a person. So Pitta people need a lower intensity. They could still have a strong workout, but a lower intensity and even work to being less mentally intense and less rigid and less competitive, because that's their natural inclination. Vata people do much better movements that are soft and sweet and have a little bit of an artistic feel to them. Vata people in general love like dancing. They'll choose dancing as a form of exercise and self-expression. Yoga-wise, we work with different doshas as far as where the gaze is set. So Vata people, because they're so up here, we advise them to look downward, keep a downward gaze so that it's more grounding for them. Pitta people, we advise a soft gaze at the horizon. So just really trying to find that, you know, that balanced place. And Kapha people, if they lift the gaze up, it lifts the energy. You know, where the eyes go, it really affects where the energy is. Pranayama.
Can we stay with asana for a moment? Sorry. Just real quick, before you go to pranayama, I'm imagining you're taking a yoga class and the teacher says, we're going to be in this pose for 60 seconds. Could you describe how best like to balance each dosha within the 60 seconds?
So holding an asana for 60 seconds can be challenging for a Vata person. And so just working on focusing the mind on the breath is a great tool for a Vata person, focusing the attention on whatever is on the ground. And for a Pitta person, softening up into the pose, just relaxing this, trying not to perform it so hard, trying not to be perfect at it. And the Kapha person, it's like a hang in there, baby. Hang in there.
I find my Kapha wants, like what helps when we're in the prolonged hold is to bring in a little bit of movement. So let's say it was like a downward dog. That might be like the pedaling or maybe some shifting.
Yes. A little bit of movement, a little bit of maybe pulsing with the breath a little bit, letting the breath move you into the pose. Yeah.
So softening, I as a yoga teacher, I want to just reinforce. I can always go back and watch the podcast, but little pulsing for the Kaphas, softening for the Pittas, and focusing for the Vatas.
Yeah. Yes, I lost a little bit of what you said.
That's okay. Yeah. So focusing for the Vatas, softening for the Pittas, and pulsing for the Kaphas.
Yeah, pulsing. You know, feeling the movement with the breath, feeling the movement of the body with the breath, being aware. You know, so I think like of a forward fold, where you're, you know, inhaling and lengthening and exhaling, folding. So you're like really in tune with that, those minute movements of the body.
And thinking for Vatas as well, like the tendency to probably like I'm breathing while I'm practicing versus connecting my breath with my movement and really dialing it in.
Yes.
So this is like Ayurveda informed yoga.
Ayurveda is, I mean, everything is Ayurveda informed once you start really connecting what Ayurveda is. It's the science of life. So it's everything, it's a medicine, it's a poison, it's great for me on this day, it's not good for me on that day. It's, you know, it's a constant titration of how you do everything.
So can we shift gears to one last topic?
Yes.
Okay. just because I know this is a shared love and I'm learning so much from you, I'd feel remiss to not include it, which is the topic of Sanskrit as a language. For those of us that are listening that are not too familiar, could you give just a little take around why it is special in the family of language systems to you?
it's special in lots of things. Of course, I've come to study Sanskrit because it is the language of all of these vidyas that, you know, all the shastras of Jyotish, all of the texts of Ayurveda, all of the texts of yoga, all are initially Sanskrit, and everything is not directly translatable to an English word. The vibrational quality of Sanskrit, learning Sanskrit, is just—I don't even have a word to describe how that's affected me. And P.S. learning, my teacher told me this is going to prevent Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, I'm in, I'm doing it. But the understanding, the depth of understanding, the word roots of the language of all of the other things that I'm living was just a natural, you know, how can I not study this? Mm-hmm. As someone who really enjoys my own language, it's been fascinating to find how Sanskrit roots are so many English words. And so just that connecting piece has been a fascinating thing to study. And even the writing of the Devanagari, that's a meditation, and it's like a yoga in and of itself. So it's just a beautiful, beautiful language. One of the loveliest things about Sanskrit is that where our language, where English is very I based, you know, I am going to the store, I am eating this banana. Sanskrit will, you know, to the store, you know, it's to the store I go, to the store. Mm-hmm. And it's so less egocentric, and it's, mm-hmm. it's in alignment with everything else that we're studying, that we've come to know, the spec that we've come to know about yoga and all of its sisters. It's a dimension that I can't leave out if I'm going to really understand.
It's interesting to me that in our studies of Sanskrit, there's aspects of it that are understanding etymology or the roots of the words. There are aspects of it that are about the pronunciation of the words, and there's aspects of it that are about the prosody or the meter of how we construct sentences. And it goes right into this beautiful rhythm. And here's this language, right? This root language, even there's that rit, mm-hmm. Sanskrit, Prakriti, Vikriti, like, so when we have this, this language that is root to so many of our other Indo-European languages, I think it behooves us to study it. And one of the things that has inspired me in studying with you, and I'm going to pause myself and say, can you define for people before I say what I'm going to say, the word Devanagari, because I just heard you use it a moment ago. I want to make sure people don't feel lost.
It's the language of the gods.
Mm. Deva, gods, like divine. Mm-hmm. And then Nagari, Naga. Is that connected to language? I know Nada or.
I don't
know. Not sure. Okay.
No, I don't.
It's important to say when we don't know. So the word Sanskrit, so san, sam, with, or same, and krit, create, to, so the word itself for the language means with creation.
Right. Right. Wow. And it's considered, and another definition is just like perfection.
Yeah, I mean, that would make sense.
So
right?
Sanskrit is considered the polished jewel
It, you know, I don't know if you've come across this, Mary, but it, there's this technology. I forget what it's the actual name of it is, but it can project the image of a sound. Have you seen this before?
I have seen it in your teacher trainings. You've described this to us about the vibration, how it's actually you can see. So tell us again.
Yeah, it's super cool for our listeners to check out. You can just search this up on YouTube. A couple of neat things are like most languages, if you speak them, it just doesn't generate any sort of geometrical coherence. But for the languages of Hebrew and Sanskrit, it does. And Latin, that's really...
Isn't it Latin also does that?
You know what? I'm not sure. I that might be one worth looking up, but what I have seen is how we can get something visual and structural in form, three-dimensional in form, out of something that is more formless, right? Sound is that in-between space. There's, you know, we say, you know, in that first there was the word, or we say in yoga about the om, and it's just like, wow, for something to go from the unmanifest to the manifest, sound is both. Like, you can't hold it in your hand, but you can all hear it, and it's here, and we can agree that it's here. And so it has elements of formlessness and form, which is so fascinating. But this particular form that means with creation in polished jewel, you all of a sudden express it. And what happens is the three-dimensional reality contorts in a geometrically coherent way to represent shapes. And wow, imagine what that's doing to the molecular structures of your body or to the environment. And so here was this ancient language that essentially codes the environment around it when it goes from formlessness out into form. And we talk about the Big Bang, we're it, and it's coming in the form of Sanskrit, which interestingly, the sound of om, even if you put like dried, like uncooked rice on a drum head, because it holds vibratory expression, then it will reshape the vibration of you chanting, not banging the drum with your hands, just chanting near it, will move all the pieces of rice into an actual circle. And fascinatingly, and that is on YouTube that you can go and check out. But also interestingly, there is in the CMBR, going back to space for a moment, which is the cosmic microwave background radiation, the capacity to hear history. We can actually hear everything going back to the Big Bang. And when you tune into the Big Bang, it literally sounds like an om. And so, wow, right? Full circle. And you start to look at all these words. It's not just the meaning that they inscribe for our intellects, but they're put in these Devanagaris. These are like the symbols, not like the letters in English. So you have these ancient zip files, like Fibonacci coding inside of these symbols. And when you crack open the symbol and express the sound of it, it generates the experience of the thing that the meaning is pointing to. And that, and then you look at the word, and the word means with creation. It's just like, okay.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, how are we not lit up by that? You know, and how, like, definitely we should study this, right? And get to know it a little bit better and see what it brings into our world. So that said, is there anything else that you would like to plant here, to live here in this podcast? Anything that feels like we didn't get to that's on your heart?
I think we got to it all. And I even learned a lot being interviewed.
I've learned a lot as well. And I hope that you guys tuning in and listening or watching this on YouTube are learning a lot too. And I appreciate the openness to maybe enter into some territories that could feel unfamiliar and new. How exciting is that we get to open our minds and try on some new things and just see what the impact of them are, and let that impact be the testament of its value for us. And I know I've received value, and Mary, you, I know you have received value, and you give this value out to people to really extract something from ancient times and practices and put it within modern context to support healing the divide. So thank you for the work that you're doing, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Bye.
Bye.